Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. In the quarry, fox and other critters of the wild, Catskills naturalist Leslie Sharp trains her eye and narrative gifts on these and other New York wildlife through her tales of close observations as a naturalist living in the great western Catskills. The Quarry Fox is the first in-depth study of Catskill wildlife since John Burroughs invented the genre of nature writing, in which Sharp weaves her experiences with the seasons, plants, and creatures with the natural history of each organism, revealing their sensitivity to and resilience against the splendor and cruelty of nature. The Quarry Fox is a celebration of the natural world and our place in it. Leslie Sharp will be giving a presentation, Q&A, and book signing at Oblong Books and Music in Rhinebeck, New York, tonight at 6 o'clock. Tonight at 6 o'clock, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Leslie Sharp to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm so delighted to be on. I can't tell you. I'm very honored.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to have you. We were talking just before you went on that we hail from very similar parts of the world. You are also from the Philadelphia
area.
That's
right.
And we were talking about these areas that I grew up with that were completely open. We lived, I think you did,
yes,
like a few miles, 10, 15 miles outside of the city. And, well, all of that's gone now.
It is all gone.
And so I assume as a naturalist, is that what you said, oh, this is leaving us, so I'm leaving too?
No. My dad used to tease me when I was in New York City, because I came to do my graduate work at Columbia, you know, quite a few years ago. And he used to say, I never understood what a nature girl like you was doing in New York City. Because as a kid, you know, I was big on birds. I was one of the things I'm most proud of. I was president of the Junior Audubon Society in second grade. I wear that like a great badge of honor. And part of it was because growing up, even in the Chestnut Hill area, we would go on nature walks, and there were these wonderful natural areas like we were talking about. And it was just as I got older, I was still in the city in the 90s, there was a terrible oil spill in the New York waterways, and it kind of snapped me back into not just sort of giving to environmental groups, but that's when I got involved with New York City Audubon. And then it was about 13 years ago that I decided to go up to the Catskills, having discovered the Western Catskills as being so different from the Eastern Catskills, which I also love. My Catskill friends who I know are listening. But it was this place of wide valleys and sort of rolling foothills. And I had just been in the Grand Canyon area, and it was so monumental, the scale, that I was looking for something quieter and gentler, and I found it in the Catskills, even though, as I turned out, it's still in its way, as it was once described when the first Europeans got here, it can still be a howling wilderness, which is also one of the appeals of it.
I want to get into the book and get into the wildness of the Catskills, but before we completely leave Philadelphia, which of course was as you mentioned Audubon, but that's Audubon country. Audubon grew up there.
And that's right.
Did you ever go to the house?
Yes, yes.
That freaked me out as a kid because there are all these dead animals there, and
yes,
the birds, and I could not compute as a young child of why he was a great naturalist and was killing all of these beautiful creatures.
Well, I think it's such a difference. It's very different, obviously, then and now. But the only way that they could really study animals,
yes,
was to shoot them. And at least that's what it felt. I mean, like Roger Torrey Peterson came along, who was the great sort of bird illustrator with his wonderful guides of the 20th century. And in a way, he changed the way people looked at it because he said, you know what, we can identify them through these paintings that I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And so it was a total change. And it was also a time the passenger pigeon wasn't yet extinct. One of the things as a kid, as a little girl, you know, pasting stamps in my little Audubon book, I remember the passenger pigeon, and it made me so uneasy, and it haunted me, and it still does, that these birds that once covered the sky were shot out of existence. So it was a time when people were much more casual. Even John Burroughs, who was like my writing father, you know, if you read him, he talks about, like, you know, shooting like a father bluebird in nesting season so we can have the specimen, and then thinking, well, I think the mother will do all right. And it's like, how could you do that, John?
Yes.
Burroughs? Or shooting a hummingbird. Completely different attitude. It's not it's really about nature study. That's what they were doing.
And it made sense at the time.
I guess it did. It's really impossible for us to fathom it, but it's useless to make a value judgment. It's just a different way now. And part of it is the scarcity of resources everywhere. And, you know, songbirds, like a lot of other creatures, including our bats and our bees, are in decline.
So it because I remember just spending so much time over there, and they had these wonderful nature trails in the Audubon Preserve, and you would walk all through that, and you obviously they didn't want you to touch anything,
right.
They didn't want you to do anything, and then I would always say to my mother, well, okay, but
yeah, but he shot the birds.
They're all dead in there.
Yeah, they're all dead, and I mean, can't touch anything.
I don't want to kill anything, but good Lord.
So funny. It's true, though. It is true.
So you come to the Catskills, and so how did the book ultimately come to be? Did you say I'm going to write this, a conscious decision, I want to write this book, or is it something that sort of evolved over time?
It was more organic. I mean, I'm also a writer as well as an editor and a former writing teacher, and I used to do personal essays for New York Newsday, where I was a contributor, and I've done them for many, including writing about the human life and the wild and urban wildlife of New York City. And I did that in my capacity as editor of Audubon, too. But for this book, it really began in an organic way. And the irony is, and it's a lesson for all you writers out there, because there are many wonderful writers in this area. I fell in love with a bluebird family that was nesting in one of the bluebird boxes, and it was a summer of madness. They had one nest, then the father, which often happens, disappeared. He probably been taken by the red-tailed hawk. And it was this incredible nerve-wracking summer of trying to sort of monitor and help Mama Bluebird with her young, which included things like me putting an umbrella over the box when it got too hot, that of course promptly fell on the box. I mean, the poor birds. And that was the first essay called A Passion for Bluebirds. And ironically, it's not in this final version because my editor and I were talking and she said, you know, there are a lot of birds in this book, and I love that bluebird essay, but didn't you have something in your proposal about Catskill wildcats? And I said, yes. And she said, everybody loves cats. Could you do that? And we'll save the bluebird for the sequel. So I said, okay. And, you know, as I said, it's a lesson for writers because you have to always consider the good of the book is the whole.
Sure.
And even though you fall in love with something and those bluebirds are maybe almost the closest greatest to my heart, and ironically, that's what started it. Now, the Quarry Fox essay, that is really the hinge of the book. And when I did that out of my experience with that extraordinary animal, and then, of course, tying it into Bluestone, which is another extraordinary part of our mountains, then I realized after that, I realized I had so many wonderful encounters with those critters, my black bear, you know, my black bear family of three generations, you name it, that I said, this is something that I wanted to do, not only to tell the stories of my observations with the latest science, but also as a way of introducing people to the natural world and reminding them that it's an interconnected world and we're at the center of that interconnectedness. That's really, I think, the point of the book, especially in these days with so much of our environment being under threat, including our natural ecosystems.
Wesley Sharp is our guest. The name of the new book, The Quarry Fox and Other Critters of the Wild Catskills. It's published by Overlook, and we'll get into where she's going to be talking and signing the new book. When it comes to, let's take the quarry fox, for example, would I know that with an untrained eye,
right.
would I say, okay, that I see a fox?
Right.
And not know that it is a quarry fox?
Well, the only reason it's really called the quarry fox is because it was a fox that essentially had as its territory the quarry on the other side of the mountain.
Okay.
So it was just really where the fox seemed to be living, and it seemed to be known to all the quarrymen. So it was just a way of identifying it as a special creature in its habitat, the quarry fox. And it's a great phrase. You know?
It is a great phrase.
That's it.
It is a great phrase.
It just occurred to me.
But what type of fox is it?
We would call it a red fox.
A red fox.
It's the standard fox that can have various color morphs, but it's that fox that you see with the beautiful red coat, the white chest, the black boots. It has variations. I have a creamsicle fox, which is like an orange fox. And, you know, there can be a black morph to that, too. But it's that standard red fox, we would call it.
I know all baby animals are cute.
They are cute.
But fox babies are
adorable.
Oh, my God, I could watch them for hours.
I know.
We've had them, been lucky enough a couple of years to have them live in a side of a, I won't say a cliff, but kind of an overhang.
Right, that's where they like
to go. Where they live in there. And
right.
Watching them play is
so much fun.
There is
right?
nothing more joyful than that.
Baby animals, especially canids, as they call them, and felines. There's something magical about that creature, too, because when I first saw the fox, and I was able to really observe this guy up close, it's uncanny the way it sort of jumps and lands on prey and holds it. It's so feline in its movements, and that observing it, I almost wondered, was there this kind of mixing between a cat and a dog that produced this animal? Because it has so many feline characteristics, including the way it even will arch its back, like a Halloween cat will do to sort of puff itself up.
Right.
But it is considered a canid. It has a nice long snout. It has canine teeth. But it has those feline slit eyes that really refract the light and enable it to see so well at light. It's a mystical creature, not only because it's crepuscular, dawning dusk, but because it has elements, it seems, of both of these really wonderful species, the felines, the cats, and the canids, the dogs.
I was just finishing reading up the book earlier this week, mm-hmm. and I was leaving the house early in the morning. My wife and I carpooled together. We were coming down the driveway. And we saw a creature run across the field, and we stopped. And, it turned out to be a bobcat.
Oh, good for you.
Now, I don't...
That's pretty rare to sight one.
It is.
Yes.
And I was just blown away, and
yeah,
I thought...
that's very
okay,
cool.
So now here... And I was very excited. I really was excited.
It's exciting. And it's rare. People live in the Catskills their whole lives and don't see one of these guys.
All right. Wesley, here's my problem.
What?
So... I've been watching this family of bunnies underneath the shed.
Oh, I know. It's not easy.
Okay.
I know what you're going to say. Are they gone?
Well, I don't know.
It could be the fox. Fox really like bunnies.
Okay. You got the bunnies. You got
it's very,
the great rabbits, which I love watching them because they're just cute as anything.
The Eastern cottontails.
And they're under the shed.
Right.
Which they usually share with the woodchucks, which I don't think the woodchucks have arrived yet. They may have taken up other territory.
Right.
And then when we came home that night, there's a hawk. And
oh,
you
yes.
think, so this is the whole circle.
That's
isn't
the
it?
Whole circle. And I think one of the things that I point out as a naturalist, the hardest thing, as I always say, you can't fall in love with wild critters. And of course, I fall in love with them all the time. But the one thing I try to do is not sentimentalize them. But of course, it's very difficult to deal with that cycle of life and death. And that's all that rules nature. And as human beings, we get attached to these critters. That's not only hard, it's very hard. It's hard sometimes not to sort of call nature cruel, but it's all nature is about is preservation of different species, and everything is in that washing cycle of life and death. But it is hard because, you have coyotes will prey on fox. You know, you'll have the fox prey on rabbits. They'll just take rabbits like crazy. And hawks will prey on everything. So it just goes around and around.
I love that phrase of a washing cycle.
It really feels like that.
Great way to think of it, isn't it?
Yes, and it really is.
So when you look at the book, and specifically about the Catskills,
right.
what makes this, because I do not know that area terrifically well.
Right.
I know it. I don't know it very well.
Right.
But I enjoyed this so much because,
oh, thank you.
Because it interweaves into so many of the areas that we that
and
we
the
have
history
here
of
the
these
Northeast.
Mountains is
That's
pretty
right.
fascinating.
Absolutely.
Who would think, every time I go out into my right, immediately there's old blue, this bluestone rock. They're all over the land, these eruptions. That rock is 300 million years old. It's extraordinary and incomprehensible to me to look at that rock and say this rock is 300 million years old because we used to be a warm sea over this area and it sort of created through its motions bluestone that is the structure of these mountains that is that great building material. And that's what's extraordinary about the Catskills is the ancientness of it. And it's so accessible. That rock is 300 million years old.
So let us talk momentarily about the things that people see as issues.
Right.
The bears coming into
right.
into neighborhoods.
Yes.
The overpopulation. I don't know if you agree with that word of deer.
Well, I think the problem is obviously we're in there. It's good news, bad news situation.
Okay.
Certainly in the Catskills, it's not even so much that we're in their territory because there's so much space, and there is so much space, it's a little better. And part of that successfulness is that those mountains have regenerated because of, protections and the end of the tanning industry and, to a degree, the bluestoning industry. I think the problem, let's say, with with bears, they can become nuisances, usually because people allow them to become nuisances.
Sure.
For instance, I feed the birds in winter. Come March, those feeders go down.
Right.
You know, and they won't come if you don't attract them. And if you do attract them, they become nuisance bears and they're going to get shot. Or up in the Catskills they would. So it's mostly about trying to protect them. And people mean very well sometimes, and you know, they'll feed wild animals. Don't feed a bear, but even like a fox, and that makes the fox too familiar to people, and then the next person comes along. If you see a fox outside in the middle of the day, it's not unreasonable to fear that it could be rabid. Then they get shot. A lot of it, deer is a whole other story, and part of that is about the loss of the apex predator, which is the mountain lion. And they're actually, certainly in the Adirondacks, there's lots of conversations about should we bring them back, and that's a very tricky thing. But we don't have that apex predator. So we are the apex predator. Therefore, we have hunting season. And ultimately, it is trying to – I'm not a big fan of – I'm a fan of responsible hunters because they are the environmentalists and the conservationists' best friend. I don't mean a fan. I just mean we work together with them to preserve
right.
habitat and the integrity of territory for critters. But there really is a problem with the impact of – deer, let's say, on the vegetation, and there are no mountain lions, so it is an issue. It is, and that's why we have hunting seasons. And short of that, which is not a perfect solution, I guess we could. There are people who want to bring back mountain lions. Let me say, if I saw a mountain lion walking across my back meadow, I think I would leave. But aside
right.
from that,
no, I understand that.
Yeah.
It struck me. We were coming into the. I was driving. I think we were driving home from work just 2 or 3 days ago, and we counted. So most of our drive is rural. We live in a very rural part
right.
of Washington County. So when we're driving, we went, I think, 12 miles, and there may be in that 12 miles like 12 farms.
Mm-hmm.
We counted, quick counts, but pretty accurate, about 140 deer.
Sounds right, yeah.
That's a lot, though.
It's a lot,
and
yeah.
And they're beautiful, and I love them.
No,
I love watching them. But then I worry about them too. That they're just
well,
seems to be
yes. I mean, well, not only you know one of the big arguments for you know trying to control that deer population, even through mountain lions, is the fact that the impacts on insurance is so high because of deer strikes.
Right.
That's a very kind of economic argument for it. But it is an issue. You know, I love them too, but. It's funny to think that when the Catskills were so despoiled, there were no white-tailed deer, and they had to actually, when the Catskills were coming back, bring them and pen them at the foot of Slide Mountain to restore them to the Catskills. And people came from miles around because they hadn't seen a deer in decades. So it's a success story. That's the really good news. But, yes, there is an issue of resource management, and they do have an impact, you know, on the vegetation, certainly. I'm for mountain lions, but not near me.
You have this beautiful call in this book of a call to action for conservation. And in our final moments, what should we be doing? What should all of us be doing to understand what is around us, to respect it, and to ultimately help preserve it?
I think it's what I say in my introduction. The first thing people can do is just look. And if you really train yourself to see, you will see, you know, many miracles of the natural world. But there are many great environmental organizations, whether it's Audubon, National Wildlife, the Nature Conservancy, you can not only give money to, but you can get involved with. But there's also the backyard habitat movement, where National Wildlife sponsors this, but so do many organizations. I have a National Wildlife certified habitat, and all that means is that I have water cover, food sources, and it's sustainable. I don't use pesticides, and you don't have to have the side of a mountain in the Catskills like I'm fortunate to have. You can do that in your backyard. You can do that. I was visiting a friend in the city this week, and they're urban beekeepers,
yeah,
which is fabulous. And that our depleted honeybee population, if it's going to come back, it's going to be coming back through people like that. So there's a lot you can do on a very grassroots level just in your own backyard. And I'll tell you one thing you can do. Put out a bird bath. We forget that birds need water so much, and there's nothing more fun than watching birds take a bath.
No, it's very funny.
It's very funny because it's very human somehow.
Very joyful
exactly.
and beautiful.
Exactly.
you are going to be at Oblong Books.
Yes, I am.
Tonight in Rhinebeck at 6 o'clock, and you'll be having a talk and a Q&A and a signing. I just want to real quick mention that it's oblongbooks.com. You also are going to be at the Wilbur Mansion and Oneonta on the 20th of this month.
That's
on the 22nd,
right.
You'll be at Inquiring Minds in New Paltz. And you have two events at the Catskill Center in Arkville on Saturday, May 13th, and on April 30th at the Catskills Literary Festival, also
right.
in Arkville. So a lot going on.
It is, and I want to thank the wonderful Golden Notebook and wonderful Northshire who have already had me reading and signing there. They've been great.
Excellent. Oblong Books tonight at 6 o'clock, and it the name of the book, The Quarry Fox and Other Critters of the Wild Catskills. It's published by Overlook. I adore this book. I adore your work, and I thank you so much for sharing.
Thank
with
you
us
so
this
much,
morning.
Joe. Fellow Philadelphian, who knew we would find each other up here?
It's a great pleasure. I'm glad we did.
It's a great pleasure
we'll
indeed.
We'll be
thank
back
you.
Right after this.